Welcome to Packet Pushers, the technology podcast for people who have their eyes wide open, their minds free of best practices, and ready to look closely at the future with the expectation that it's possible and not actually dreaming. Today, I'm joined by John Free, who is a senior analyst at More Insights Strategy Group. And we're just going to be banging over some of the topics that have been interesting to us in the last, few weeks. John and I have been banging backwards and forwards on Twitter about various topics, and really 140 characters doesn't get you very many insights or deep discussion into the topic. So, John, welcome to the Packet Pushers. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Yeah. Now, you and I have been going back and forth. Sometimes we agree to disagree, and sometimes we even agree to agree, which is quite unusual, I think.
Absolutely.
So what I've done is I picked up on some of the conversations that we've had over the last month or so, and I thought we would pick up the threads of those and maybe take those out of the realms of 140 characters into a long conversation. Now, the one that we threw around last week was there was a quote from David Yurlevich, who's the VP of Cisco Security, who in a recent session at a financial conference, as covered by the SDX Central people, said that SDN still stands for still does nothing. Now, color me cynical, but Cisco as a company has spent roughly $2 billion in the last 3 or 4 years buying SDN companies, such as Cisco's Insieme business unit with the ACI product, and more recently Viptela with their software-defined WAN. So it seems a bit comical that a senior executive would suddenly pop up and say SDN still does nothing, even if you're in the security business unit, right?
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's really short-sighted. This feels like somebody protecting his own turf versus really taking a more long-term look at what's happening in his business. I would think, especially from a security standpoint, you'd be looking at SDN and saying the biggest problem with network security today is the lack of flexibility, and SDN could be that silver bullet to help me get a little more flexibility. So it's odd that he kind of came out with that position, but maybe he's trying to protect existing business.
Yeah. Well, the exact quote is, internally at Cisco, employees joke that SDN really stands for still does nothing, but we think it might actually stand for security defined networking. And I'm like, oh, please. Like, I know a lot of Cisco is still stuck in the past. I mean, this is a company that still produces the CAT 6500, 15 years, nearly 20 years now that product has been out there, and they're still pushing it to customers as a brand new innovation platform.
Yeah, and to say security defined network, basically, I mean, it's tracking to my point, which is the guy's somewhat got his head in the sand or thinking about things from simply a security standpoint or his own business unit standpoint. He ought to be thinking about software defined security. And I hear a lot of people talking software defined security these days because they want to have a little more control over their flows, be able to shut down things very quickly when stuff happens. And if you make your security software defined as opposed to making your network security defined, I think you've got more flexibility. So he just needs a little shift there.
Well, I mean, software defined security is, or security defined networking. It's never going to be called security defined networking, but software defined security. There are companies out there doing that. Obviously, VMware's NSX is really a security play, not a networking play. It's about securing. Micro-segmentation is its primary pitch, and increasingly they're talking about personal firewalls for each server and each app in the data center, like on containers and the VM. And this week we saw Illumio raise $125 million, and they're fundamentally extending the edge of the secure network right the way into the app. So they're trying to apply personal firewalls via a software-defined controller strategy. So they've pulled in $267 million in funding in their lifecycle. So really? A Cisco security executive still says that, really doesn't get this yet? Seems really obscure.
Yeah, yeah. I think he was probably looking for a nice soundbite and something that might play well to the audience. It feels way more like politics than it does technology or strategy.
So this is Cisco's business units. This is this idea that inside of Cisco, the business units spend as much time fighting with each other for the health of the company. So the idea is the company should never get stagnant, should never be stuck with a dead end. You have multiple business units all hating on each other and fighting each other for success. And that was the model that John Chambers set up in the 80s when General Electric had the, Jack Welch in charge. Does that model still relevant going forward, do you think?
I think that model was great back when things were moving slowly and you had enough, from a vision standpoint, all you had to worry about was what was in the next 5 years, and the horizon looked pretty straightforward. And, it was like, all right, we're we're going to deploy x86 and move all our applications there. Okay, we're going to deploy VMware and we're going to virtualize everything. Now, who knows what the hell is going on? It's digital transformation. It's reinventing businesses and all the other buzzwords that people throw out. If you said to somebody, what are you going to do over the next 5 years? They probably have a vague, fuzzy answer for the direction that they're heading, but nobody knows with any surety. And that's the problem that you face. And in a world where you want to have your business units fighting with each other, that's great if you have a clear endpoint that you're going for and tell me how you're going to get to that endpoint, but nobody knows where they're going now.
Yeah, increasingly, well, the joke, it's not a joke, but the way I look at Cisco these days is it's a bit like Walmart. It's got one of everything lined up in the aisles, and it's probably not the best of. It might not be the cheapest or the worst of, but it's just there's a lot of it piled high.
Right. They're basically putting down bets on everything. If you cover all your bets, one of them is going to hit. It's a roulette strategy.
But history tells us that in the case of Cisco, 50-70% of all products fail quickly, and very few of them actually survive. Like the Nexus 6000 in terms of switches has disappeared pretty quickly. We've seen any number of acquisitions go inside of Cisco and then just fold within a few months. You don't get that many successes like Meraki for the business in terms of, you know, turning into something valuable, or even look at Aruba over at HPE. They've got the same sort of thing where they've managed to stay successful even as the rest of the business sort of struggles to maintain, you know, whatever. That's an exception, not the rule. And I'm a customer, I should be concerned, I think, that Cisco doesn't know what the future looks like.
Well, and that's part of the problem. With a really wide portfolio, it's hard to invest to make all of those different business units successful. And that's why they're all fighting for market share, not in the market. They're fighting for market share within the company. They're fighting for budget market share. And, you know, Walmart is a great example. You got one of everything. Now, who's Walmart's biggest competitor here in the States? It's Costco. I'm obviously Amazon, but you know, Costco's model is I'm going to have 4,000 to 5,000 SKUs. I'm not going to have everything. And I go to Costco, you want dishwashing detergent. There's two brands. There's the Costco brand, and then there's, you know, a Calgon or whatever. Yeah. And I'm going to choose one of the two. You go to your typical grocery store here in the US, you got 12 to 15 different kinds. And the choice is overwhelming. They're going to get successful because they got two brands of dishwashing detergent, and you're going to choose one of the two. But damn it, you're going to buy it from Costco.
Yeah, that's what I get. People keep saying, you know, Cisco is a strategy, or your vendor is meant to be a strategic choice, and they'll have the best of breed, and you buy whatever the vendor has because there's a partnership in place. But if your vendor starts to look like a portfolio of startups, does that, you know, puncture that a vision of stable, reliable, trustworthy business partner eventually, or in the short term, or is it a long-term thing and they get time to recover?
No, I think it actually hurts you. You know, imagine you're the sales guy, or you're the customer, and the sales guy from Cisco comes in and talks about all these different things, and you look at him in the eye and say, well, what do you think I should do? And he kind of looks back at you and goes, oh, what do you want to do?
Yeah, I'll pick the one that has the biggest profit margin or has the biggest bonus this month. You know, bonuses on ACI because ACI is the hot thing. You know, that's why a lot of ACI is being sold at the moment, is because the sales reps get additional commission.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they're pushing hard on that. You know?
And it's Cisco's only answer to, I mean, only real answer out in the market, SDN. They've been telling everybody forever, ACI is software-defined networking. So
Doing that. I think the ACI people have been telling people that.
Well, there you go. And and if the ACI guy is the guy talking to you, he is Cisco.
Yeah, yeah. Does that business model last for much longer? Like, we've seen IBM and HPE sort of, you know, shrinking rapidly and struggling to stay relevant. Cisco's growth is effectively zero. The only way it's growing is by spending its profits to, you know, expand into adjacent markets. Do you think we're seeing the end of the supermarket model for IT and breaking down into a specialist best of breed back where we were 15 years ago? Or is there still, you know, a place like HPE's divested itself of all of its accessories that, you know, the legacy stuff. And now it's just down to, you know, service storage, networking to some extent. And you know, those, that core portfolio around IT infrastructure, is that the smallest part where it's going to go, or are they going to go back to being multi-lane supermarkets again?
You know, I think you're going to see an expansion and contraction across all these businesses. So HPE, they pared themselves down to a pretty small, you know, bucket of product. And then what did they do? They've gone out and they've done some acquisitions with the cash that they have. So they're going to expand and they'll get themselves to the point where they can't manage it anymore. And they'll say, all right, now it's time for us to scale that back a little bit. So I think it's going to go back and forth. But I think we're not in a market where companies are expanding or contract or markets are contracting or expanding. We're in a market where individual companies are contracting or expanding. And it comes down to what have I got and how can I grow my market share? So The guys who are most interesting are some of these smaller companies who have an opportunity to get bought up by somebody who can actually do something with them. Getting bought up by an HPE, if you're a networking company, might not be your best strategy because I don't know what they can do with your product. Or they've been real successful with Aruba, but you know, I've spent a lot of time with them. The Aruba team is very much a different team. They work for Aruba, who happens to be owned by HPE.
Yeah, look at like the Meraki business model and certain of the IBM business units and Dell EMC. EMC is still very much, you know, they still own the customers they've always owned, and they don't really. Not really part of Dell yet.
Yeah, yeah. And the guys who are going to be most successful are going to be the guys that have a really good technology that breaks all the industry standards and gives a competitive advantage, and the headline company gives them the opportunity to run things their own way. And that isn't always the case.
Yeah, see, and that point, it really comes down to, so then what you're saying is that Cisco, HP have, you know, have got access to the customers via the channel because that's a channel partnership or existing relationships. And that comes back to the supermarket model. People go buy what's ever in the supermarket. So you're saying startups. So what happens when startups just start putting their products in the supermarket, you know, the Cisco supermarket or the HP supermarket, what happens to enterprise IT then? Because that's the logical thing is that HPE and Cisco don't buy these companies anymore. Look at what they're doing with ACI. Effectively, ACI looks like a supermarket because you can put F5 on it, Checkpoint, Palo Alto, blah, blah, blah. They've built a platform and customers come on to ACI and then they can get access to all these other things. And ACI starts to look like Amazon at that point.
It looks like Amazon, except that ACI is, think of ACI as still being a physical store and they don't have that many locations around the country and they've put them at really crappy intersections. and there's your functional problem is ACI looks good and they always talk about growth, but it's growth off a small base.
Now, people still, I hear more overall, I hear very little positive about ACI and more negative when I talk to people face to face. I'd like to see ACI do better, but it's hard to get a positive image about it still after all this time, by the way, and all the money that's been thrown at it.
Yeah. 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 I mean, the thing I always tell people is, you know, in the street, the word is ACI stands for All Cisco Infrastructure. And and if you look at the largest companies, the guys that are deploying ACI, they are dyed-in-the-wool Cisco shops. And that's great. ACI is a great solution if your entire network is Cisco. ACI is not that great a solution if you're trying to find this best of breed or you're trying to utilize different vendors.
If you're willing to stay committed to Cisco and you've got more money, you've got plenty of money to fund that sort of an approach and you're not really interested in value or price control or account, you know, keeping control of your destiny, then that's a good choice. Yes, I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a great choice if you're one of those businesses who's in an industry that isn't changing much. There's not much transformation. You know, some of the manufacturing sectors are like that. Some of the traditional banking sectors are like that. But you're not going to find that in some of the areas that are facing this, you know, quote unquote, digital transformation. Or, you know, if there's a lot of IoT that you're thinking about integrating, ACI might not be your best solution because there's, you know, there's going to be too much change in the market around the things you're going to want to do with your network.
You keep talking to people who are using NSX or one of the other SDN tools, and you know, Cisco keeps trying to position ACI as that, you know, what you put that underneath, and that seems to be like, you know, got to keep control of the customer, got to keep yourself in the game, but you can't not sell ACI. I don't understand. That seems to be unwise. That just seems like a lot of money for not much gain.
Yeah, yeah. And NSX falls into that same camp. NSX is an awesome solution for people that are all VMware. But NSX falls down when people want to start doing other types of virtualization, other containers, other hypervisors.
Yeah.
You know, NSX becomes less interesting to them because of some of the limitations that it's got.
And you've still got the physical network, which hasn't been, you know, you either have to build a brand new network on which it runs, you know, a layer 3 ECMP leaf spine, and that's where your NSX runs, but you still haven't automated your legacy network. And I actually think that's probably the best way to go, just to pretend your legacy network is finished with and treat it like it's a legacy system and migrate over to the new one over time.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good idea.
Mm. So SD-WAN, what's your take on SD-WAN at this point in time? We saw Viptela get bought by Cisco for $600 million and some change. Is it going to be the future that SD-WAN is going to be the default? Every router will be an SD-WAN edge device, and that's table stakes. We've talked about that before on the show. Is that how you see it playing out?
Yes and no. Yes, absolutely. You're 100% correct. But with everything, the no part is it's going to take time. So I look at the market and I say SD-WAN is going to be the way everybody operates 20 years, 10 years from now. But SD-WAN has got a long way to go before it gets there. And I had talked about, I wrote an article where I said, look, the bottom line is there's going to be some consolidation. We've got about 20, 30 players in the market right now, and most of them are going to go out of business. Most that stay in business will get bought up, but they will get bought up in receivership. They won't get bought up with the Viptela kind of money. There's probably room for one other big company, and I laid out CloudGenix, VeloCloud, Versa Networks, and Silverpeak as companies that might get bought up in a Viptela kind of arrangement, probably with less premium than Viptela. And then beyond that, everybody else is going to fight for, you know, third and fourth place. And long-term, right now, today, you have companies doing SD-WAN. In the future, every large company is going to have an SD-WAN product. Eventually, SD-WAN is going to become a feature, and then it becomes table stakes. And what do you mean you don't do SD-WAN? That's insane. Mm. So there's a progression that's going to happen. It's going to happen over time. But you probably have one or two good pops of other companies like Viptela that get bought out. It'll be real interesting to see who does it.
So you're suggesting that it's still a winner takes. So you think networking is still a winner takes all market? That is, the company that moves first will win the market. Or if you're the incumbent with the greatest market share, you'll continue to own the market and control all aspects of it. So Cisco buying out Viptela means that Cisco will retain its dominant position, and the rest will just be Cisco and the seven dwarves, like we've had in networking for the last 20 years.
Yeah, it's probably going to be close to that. I don't see a dramatic shift. I don't see some dark horse coming out. I don't see an HPE or a Dell buying up Versa Networks, for instance, and then suddenly moving into a number two position and seriously challenging Cisco.
But okay, so there's a couple of transitions here that make me want to question that logic. I agree with that logic. I can see how you get there, but I actually believe something different might happen. That this point in time, disaggregation, commoditization, open source changes the economics of this. So I can now go and buy a small x86 server. We've seen the rise of these IoT devices from HPE and Dell. So they don't actually need to make custom routers anymore. They just need to make an x86 server with a few Ethernet ports on it, which they already make for their IoT. So they could actually bring an SD-WAN product to market, which is just software that runs on a device which is used for many other things, IoT-like. Some of them even come with 5G, 4G modems in them. And you don't actually need to hold a whole inventory. You don't need to have stock. You don't need to have a whole business unit. This is my new SD-WAN platform. And I don't actually have to sell routers. I don't have to support DMVPN or BGP or MPLS. This is just my SD-WAN. And it's possible that this could emerge as, instead of competing head-on, you've got the system where the cost of having an SD-WAN strategy is marginal. It uses hardware investments I've already got and I'm selling to other people, a bit like Dell is selling its switches to Big Switch and Pluribus and a range of other vendors to put their operating systems on. They could build an SD-WAN strategy around that too, couldn't they?
Yeah, yeah. As a matter of fact, Dell has really nice IoT gateway devices that you could, you know, I mean, it's running x86, you could run SD-WAN on top of that. But I think that IoT and branch office are two different. I had this conversation last night with somebody I work with that, you know, his point was, well, it's all going to become one big mess. And I said, no, branch office automation is going to be kept separate from IoT for the most part, because IoT is partially owned by OT, the operation technology people, as opposed to IT, the information technology. So I think there's still a differentiation there. I think the idea that SD-WAN becomes a branch office automation and somebody like a Dell or an HPE can take their existing IoT gateway and package it as that product, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. See, then all of a sudden challenges the market, because now they don't have to have, like, there's no longer this idea of the network mainframe, which is a custom hardware with a custom operating system with custom apps, and you sell it as a one unit, and it happens once every 5 years or 10 years. We could get to the point where it's, I've got a device on site, and I'm just going to sell them Microsoft Windows this year, and next year it'll be Red Hat Linux.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I think we'll eventually get there. How we get there and how quickly people undo all of their existing WAN infrastructure and go software defined, there's a lot of things that have to happen first. And the biggest one right now that most of the customers I talk to are running into is, hey, I found this great SD-WAN solution, and I want to also use my carrier, and they're going to start using SD-WAN for some of my connectivity to the cloud. And I acquired this other company, and by God, they've got an SD-WAN product that they were using for, you know, connecting to all their branch offices. And now suddenly I need an SD-WAN to SD-WAN connectivity layer, and I need some way for all of these pieces to talk to each other. And right now, today, that doesn't happen. There's the guys in Onug are trying to do that. They've got some projects. But until you get this kind of universal translation layer that lets all of your SD-WAN components talk to each other across vendors.
But see, that's like saying Windows and Linux need to talk together, and they don't, right? So I don't think you need the SD-WAN companies. Like CloudGenix has their solution, Viptela has their solution, or, you know, any of the other vendors that are out there, right? I'll just pick those. And today, when you either choose to be a Microsoft Windows house, or you're a Linux shop, Red Hat Linux, or an Ubuntu, and those systems kind of work together, but they kind of don't, and you either pick one or the other. Why do we not do that with SD-WAN?
Well, I moved to Mac from Windows, and one of the things that actually forced me to choose the Mac was the fact that Microsoft helped me, because Microsoft made Windows the Office model so appealing. They basically said, look, you can run it on Windows, you can run it on Mac. It's one license, you get up to 5 installs, and you know, I can open up a file on my Mac, I can open up a file in a Windows VM, and it's treated exactly the same. And so that universal translation makes it a lot easier for me to shift and have a little more flexibility. And that's kind of what I'm saying, is you need that universal translation where it isn't a huge engineering project to get multiple SD-WANs running. That's where this stuff really takes off.
Yeah, I think we're already there, right? If you can get to the point where it's white box, or there's, you know, you could use anybody's hardware, HPE, it's all x86, and there's a standardized sort of box that's SD-WAN, you know, and you could run CloudGenix or Viptela or Telari or TeloIP or Meraki on top of that hardware, away you go.
Yeah, and I wouldn't even say or, I would say and. So you can run all of those together.
Yeah, but you probably won't, in the same way that Apple's, you know, Apple Pages is not compatible with Microsoft Word, except in some basic, simplistic way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would, to me, would be where SD-WAN, and then if HP and Dell could, you know, be rebadging anybody's SD-WAN operating system on their platform, then all of a sudden you've got a disruption, perhaps?
Mm-hmm.
Could that play? Is there enough money in networking to make that stick? Like, these companies don't get out of bed for $1 billion sort of thing.
It'll be interesting to see if a security company wants to step up and get into the SD-WAN space, because ultimately this becomes an NFV discussion, and it becomes a discussion of what's happening on the security level as to where people are going to go with their SD-WAN. And I wouldn't be surprised if one of the acquisitions somewhere somehow is a carrier who says, you know, I'm sick and tired of not having control over my customers because I'm using a VeloCloud and VeloCloud selling, you know, their product to all of my competitors. If I had my own SD-WAN, even though it's not my business, I could at least control my customers.
Yeah, but I don't. I had this discussion recently with Mike Bouchon in a show published this week. It was earlier this week, 9th of June. I actually don't believe that carriers could ever run software-defined WAN. I think it's beyond them. Those businesses are too large and too legacy to possibly adapt to a software-defined world at the customer level. I mean, they can barely even deliver a managed MPLS service.
Well, yeah, you brought MPLS into it, so there you go.
Yeah, but, you know, MPLS was a fine idea in 1998, but in 2017, you know, as a backbone technology, I'm not so sure that it's going to be what it needs to be. But one of the other things that we've been talking about on Twitter recently is product reliability. I've sort of had now my sense for this comes from I have a lot of conversations with people in chat rooms and Slack and reading the Reddit channels and people talking to me over Twitter in the back channels and LinkedIn via private messages talking about vendor product reliability and just how poor software reliability has become steadily over the years. Are you seeing that as well? Is that something that you're seeing as an analyst and talking to customers?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of it is being driven by this idea of DevOps and CI/CD, and we've got to do things quickly, and we've got to get new features in, we've got to continually rev, and we're going to be continuously updating these features. I think that is the demand for more features is killing more of the reliability. And I worked for a long time in the semiconductor world. You know, when you work in the server world, it's great because if there's a problem with the chip, lo and behold, your vendor takes care of it for you, and it's pretty easy to swap out a lot of the components. But in the semiconductor world, when you've got a problem with your product, you got a real problem. And so reliability is really high in that world because the pain of having to make changes is so huge. And I think with software, it's much easier to put bad code out there and correct it later if it causes a problem for someone. And so you're seeing a lot of people rushing towards getting these software releases out. And a lot of the discipline isn't there. And the point I was making on Twitter with you is, you know, part of the problem is there's this feedback loop. There's an IT decision maker who decides what you're going to buy. There's purchasing who figures out how you're going to buy it, what you're going to pay for it, and hammers the vendor to get the best deal. And the guys in the trenches, you know, the men and women who are dealing with this stuff every single day are the ones that know all the problems, and their feedback isn't getting back to those decision makers, and it's definitely not getting back to purchasing.
So I think that's one part of it, but what about vendors who just deliberately ignore it? So the people I've spoken to at vendor technical support lines just say that, you know, they continually getting less and less resources, like their access to test equipment, their access to internal systems is degrading, their headcount in those professional services teams, like the technical support teams, is being constantly downgraded or offshored to people who have far less skills and far less capabilities. I actually think the vendors are taking robbing Peter to pay Paul here, that their tech support lines are decreasing, so they're actually hearing less bugs. And then they use that to justify the fact that there are less bugs, because Cisco executives have certainly been getting up at conferences and saying, for example, I've noticed this over the years, we've got our best reliability ever, our bug reports are down by 10% this year, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing is, along with that, vendors are also relying on their customers to be their beta testers. So you're no longer finding the level of testing. To your point, if you don't have the resources to do, you know, the full test matrix and all the different permutations that a customer could deal with, you focus on that core stuff in the middle, you let all the edge cases float out into the market, and essentially your customer becomes your beta tester.
And that's a moral hazard, because then your developers go, I won't test. I'll skip that test. I'll just ship it and see if customers find any bugs.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they can do the testing for, I can cut my budget by not completing the testing. That must be invidious. Like, it's not, I'm not saying that that's exactly what happens, but that's a sort of false incentive that can create that sort of negative feedback loop that, you know, well, you know, customers will find the bugs. I'll just bag that up and test it and see how it works in real life and worry about it next week.
How many times have you worked at a company where they say, you know, the enemy of perfect is good enough? And so you know, good enough is 80%. If you can get, you know, 80% success in all of your testing, get the product shipped because we have revenue we need to hit.
And yeah, and I've heard stories that development teams are actually revenued on feature completion, like new feature development, not on bugs or failures or, you know, that sort of stuff. They don't actually get, you know, bonused on how few bugs are in their code. They get bonused on how fast they can develop new features and bring them to market, which, you know, makes it even doubles down on, you know, low quality, low function type stuff.
Yeah, and I've got a real good real-life example of how screwed up this can get. My own home Wi-Fi, I test a lot of different products, and I got into Mesh about 6 months ago, got a couple different products, and Google Wi-Fi was actually one of the ones that I actually went and spent my own money on because I saw a lot of promise in it. And I put it in. Everything was great for a while. I realized there was some limitations, and you know, but they were going to do feature updates every 6 weeks or so. So I figured I would probably get those. Well, somewhere along the way, I recognized that they don't allow you to actually set updates. They're going to push updates to you. You have no choice. You can't turn that off. They're going to basically own the update cycle. And they put out an update that literally took people offline for 4 to 6 weeks. Wiped out their systems. They had no way to access. They had no internet because they had a buggy update. Now, what do we do when those types of things happen? And that becomes a bigger problem as IT starts to move to more of this as a service procurement. And you see HPE, you see Dell, you see IBM all offering up to battle the public cloud this idea that, you know, IT, we'll sell you the hardware on an as-a-service basis, and we'll put the hardware in, and we'll meter it, and we'll charge you just like it's a private cloud, but guess what? You get to have your own infrastructure. Isn't that a great deal? Well, what happens when something gets screwed up?
Yeah.
If my product is screwed up and I bought it and it's a capital expense, it's somewhat my problem to fix. But you know, are these guys fully comprehending that when they start selling things as a service, they may take ownership for some of this buggy software?
And I think these cloud systems too, like I don't think people quite understand the negative impacts of giving away software. What you have to do is you have to be writing those purchase orders every month or every 6 months. You can never stop paying for those products or you lose them. Now, on the bright side, if you're willing to take strategic decisions and to say, I don't need that service, and then just stop paying the invoice and losing the service in the cloud and then not ignoring what happens to all of your data. But the systems that a lot of the things that you own, they can run indefinitely and they don't have to pay maintenance for them. They can run as is inside the moat, you know, inside the protected zone. And they don't cost you any money while you transition off to something else.
Yeah.
Whereas if you transition from cloud platform to cloud platform, you're actually carrying the cost of the previous one as well as the new one as you make the transition.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite extraordinary.
And you've been in enough data centers and you probably have, you know, walked through with the customer. They're talking about this, they're talking about that. And you look at one oddball server in the corner and you say, what's that running? I got no idea. How many customers are still running? There's an NT4O workload somewhere in their data center and they're not sure. They don't want to turn it off because we don't know what relies on that. And so they keep it running. And your operational cost at that point, everything's out of warranty, but your operational cost is power. And so it's a pittance to keep it running. Well, what happens when that's a VM or a container sitting in a cloud somewhere and you're paying each month to keep that thing running?
Yeah. And then nobody wants that in their cost center.
Right.
Which is one of those areas where I don't think people have quite worked out, you know, that, you know, you can leave it running when it's in your data center. It doesn't cost you anything and nobody's going to notice it, but when it has to be accounted for when it's sitting in the cloud.
Right.
Or it will get turned off, which could be a feature, right? And that actually is a feature of the public cloud in the sense that you are forced to do a certain amount of accounting that you've probably never done before.
Yeah, it opens up your eyes. And I think the other thing that happens on public cloud is they start to understand the economics of it a little more these days than they had initially. Initially, it was like, hey, swipe a credit card, you're up and running, this is so easy, it's so cheap. Mm. And over time, you start to look at the cost, and as things start to sprawl, you say, the reason the cloud looks so efficient relative to my on-premise IT was because I didn't have all the crap yet, but I've just introduced all the crap to the cloud. And now my cost differential, the amount of money I thought was saving is really a lot lower.
Oh, I was read an article this week about how expensive bandwidth is in the public cloud. It's 9 cents a gigabyte. 0.09 cents a gigabyte. Basically, it's 9 times the cost of what you would do in a private data center.
Mm-hmm.
So your internet connection is roughly 900% more expensive. But you don't notice that until you're in the public cloud, and then you suddenly realize how much it's costing you for an internet connection. Yeah, and I mean, if you take into account your routers and blah, blah, blahs and all the firewalls and everything like that, it's still 9 times more expensive.
And what's the big pitch on public cloud these days? IoT. So I'm going to have these very data-heavy applications sending constant telemetry 24/7 into my public cloud with expensive bandwidth. That doesn't scale.
So I guess we can wrap up that question saying you've seen increasing reliability and product quality problems in the vendor space. And, you know, increasingly, is that a fair summary?
Absolutely.
All right. Absolutely. And see, the thing that I'm seeing about this is I think eventually we get to the point where open source becomes desirable because at least you know it's going to have problems and to be unreliable as well, but at least it didn't cost you anything.
Exactly. And well, we should never say open source is free. That's probably the biggest misconception.
But what I mean is if you've gone and paid a premium price for a vendor brand of product and it comes with pretty poor quality and a raft of bugs that take months and months to fix, well, you might as well have gone and got open source in the first place, which you know has buggy and broken, is going to take months and months to fix, but at least you didn't pay the premium price for it.
Yeah, and I'd argue that open source, and I'm a big open source advocate, I'd argue that open source is actually better than proprietary because with open source, when a problem comes up, you get a whole ton of people jumping on that problem and trying to fix it. In proprietary, when a problem comes up, it has to get to a certain point and then the company fixes it. And then the last step in it, the company tells you, oh, by the way, there was a problem and now we fixed it. So how many things are under the surface that you don't even know about that they're not talking about? And how many things are happening that they don't even understand are there? So I think
increasingly vendors, I've heard reports that vendors won't accept things as bugs. They'll continue to refuse it's a bug until you give up and go away. So a lot of tech support, I wonder if tech support people actually revenued on not reporting bugs or something. There's like a negative incentive inside of companies to sort of prevent that.
Yeah, it's like the insurance companies in the US where the longer they can keep from paying a claim, the more profitable they'll be.
Well, this year, but not next year. Yeah. But there is no next year. There's only this quarter. And this is why I'm concerned about these sales-driven cultures. I think again, that creates a secondary moral hazard as well. You were at the HP Discover event this week?
No, I wasn't at it, but we had people there and I was following it.
So what did you think? What struck you? What caught your attention?
Well, it's the biggest thing that got me on this was this idea that hybrid cloud is a big push for HPE. And I think there's a realization of two things. One is IT is moving more towards public cloud. So if you look at IDC's server numbers that came out this week, enterprise sales of servers are down. And the thing that saved the server market was a huge purchase by one of the cloud players, which we believe is Amazon Web Services, buying a ton of CPUs and a ton of platforms. So there's a shift towards public cloud that's happening. And HP is putting the stake in the ground and saying, hey, not everything can get out on the public cloud. There's probably a lot of things you still want to maintain control over and keep in your data center. And so I think HPE was really strong on this idea that there's this cloud cliff, as Meg termed it, that, you know, people are starting to jump off this cloud cliff and halfway down they're saying, oh, wait a minute, what about security? What about bandwidth? You know, to your point about the cost of bandwidth a second ago. And so I think there's going to be a better opportunity for private cloud. And the guys that jump on that and get themselves positioned well are going to do well in that. But I think private cloud, you're going to see private cloud have the same kind of renaissance and start to come to life the way public cloud did a couple of years ago.
And it's a little hard to take them seriously when they all jumped onto OpenStack as the savior from public cloud and then blew it up.
Yeah.
And it still has to, I mean, if it's not OpenStack, what is it going to be? It can't be VMware's vRealize, I don't think. They can't. If they throw it to that, then VMware can always disrupt them by moving up the stack and making the hardware and infrastructure that they want to sell. I mean, composable infrastructure is not a private cloud to me. Like Cisco's made, boosting its hyperconverged supermarket by partnering with anybody who'll stand still long enough to sign an agreement. You know, they have partnerships with any storage company that'll have them. You know, UCS servers and Cisco networking with anyone's storage, Pure, Tagile, Pure, you know, Nimble, just about everybody's partnered with them, NetApp, to do hyperconverged, as well as their own internal version. It must be incredibly confusing for customers to decide which hyperconverged strategy to choose if you're going with Cisco UCS servers. And HPE is getting into hyperconverged through its converged hyperconverged through composable as well as the software-driven storage arrays. But that doesn't solve the problem of VMs and orchestration and containers and, you know, tools like Mesosphere and Pivotal. I mean, if enough companies bite off on Pivotal, CNC, you know, Cloud Foundation, I don't actually think there's going to be a private cloud because it's all going to go further and further up the stack. Like companies who use Pivotal don't actually care much about their infrastructure and they don't care much about private cloud. What they care about is Pivotal and Cloud Foundation.
Mm-hmm. And I think to your point on VMs, I actually think VMs start to go away. I think containers consume VMs the way VMs consumed standalone workloads.
Yeah, 15-year, 20-year, long-term, gradual, yeah.
Yeah, and I think when you get to containers, it becomes a lot easier to create something that could run in your data center or on a public cloud somewhere. And amazingly enough, the only guys that I think are really doing it well at this point, although they haven't really executed on the private side of it, is Microsoft with Azure. You know, you can run the same tool sets, you can run the same applications, the same containers, whether it's on the Azure public cloud or whether you're doing Azure Stack in your network. Now, Azure Stack isn't really out there, so time will tell on that. But on the AWS side, it's kind of an all or nothing. You're going to put everything in the public cloud, and OpenStack is pretty much an all or nothing pivot as well, which is you're going to run it all in your own data center. So somewhere along the line, you need somebody that says, look, I'm going to allow you to be able to do things in public and private. And Microsoft has the best story, and the story might not necessarily be a product, but it's nice.
Mm. I was looking at a company this week. I can't remember their name, but they have a liquid cooled, like an immersion bath data center thing that basically you can build a data center under your desk again. Which I thought was fantastic. I thought, actually, yeah, you know, the thing, one of the things I've always believed about the private cloud is AWS makes sense if you need more and more servers to compete, you know, to do more and more. But at the same time, you're conveniently forgetting that silicon's getting faster and smaller and consuming less power. Is there a point at which I can build a rack that's now located in the laundry closet, you know, or the broom closet, that actually has the power of an AWS, you know, that's more power than you'll ever need, and you can buy it once and never buy it again?
Well, yeah, and I think I look at AWS and I say there's a big problem with their business model, which is they built a huge, huge cloud with hundreds of thousands of nodes, and over time, the new workloads are going to be looking for new CPU features. So every single time that Intel and AMD bring out new features, they're going to want to expose them so that they can charge more for those instances. But they're still going to have a bunch of very slow generic instances to pay off the cost of all that capital equipment, that sunk investment that they already have. And that's going to be a challenge. And I think that you're going to see the gap. You're going to see leapfrogs between the cost of doing things in a public cloud versus the cost of doing things in a private. And with this new generation of CPUs that are coming out and new platforms that you're going to see from all the vendors in the next couple months, you're going to shrink that gap. And then over time, the public cloud guys are going to get a lot of that infrastructure into their systems and be able to amortize it properly, and you're going to start to get some advantages. So I think we're going to go back and forth on this in a leapfrog, just like we did on-premise with old platforms versus new platforms.
Yeah, I think also there's a lot of hype, too, about, you know, people saying, oh, but it scales infinitely large. I think the reason that a lot of startups and those rapid scaling startups who've been able to get traction, and sure, they did very well, but that's not the reality for enterprises. They just don't need to increase workloads 100% per month on month. That's just not how the game works. And the second thing there is that most venture capitalists like being in public clouds because they shut down 95% of companies that they fund. And so part of their actual technology stack is something that could be closed down with a minimum of cost because the most of the companies get closed down. And being in the public cloud means you can just turn it all off and walk, you know, cancel right. the credit card and done. You know,
exactly.
There's no assets sitting in racks that you've actually got to go and get a secondhand recovery team in and walk out of your five-year contract and pay off and blah, blah, blah when you take it into liquidation and all that sort of stuff, right?
Right. And that's why small, medium businesses are flocking to public cloud and private cloud is going to be the province of the higher-end businesses.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. Or service-oriented stuff like, you know, using Google Docs and Gmail or Office 365 or, you know, whatever it is that you're going to use. Like even just moving your Exchange servers and your SharePoints outside of your data center are going to give you a substantial advantage to be able to re-engineer your data center to some extent.
Yeah. A lot of customers I talk to will say, you know, if it's something I can differentiate for my business and I can prove it, then I want to do it in-house and I want to have it private cloud. If I can't differentiate it, you know, to your earlier point about that we were talking before the call about accounting, you know, if I can't differentiate it, why should I be paying extra money to do it on-premise? Just do it in the cloud.
Okay, so John, you brought a topic here about a Slovakian startup using OpenStack. Tell me what's the story there.
Well, it's a real small company. I think it's about a 5-person company. And they actually landed SoftBank as a customer, and SoftBank is a huge company from Japan, and they were able to do this because they offered a special version of OpenStack that they're going to manage for SoftBank. Hmm. And it's really interesting because I think it points to a couple trends, one of which is people want to get into OpenStack, but they kind of need somebody to guide them along. And you know, this startup is basically offering them a walled garden OpenStack that they can deploy, and then the startup is going to keep an eye on it and manage it and manage the updates. And it's a real easy way for somebody to get that flexibility as a large company without having to commit all the time and the resources. Because the biggest thing holding OpenStack back is you got to have people that are certified and can really go and manage it for you. It's not something that you can just plug in and let run. And so with a lack of resources out there, a lack of admin resources, you're kind of looking for somebody to guide you through that process. But the fact that somebody as large as SoftBank did this, I could see some of these other smaller startups getting, you know, consumed and become part of a large company's IT department.
Oh yeah, this is Frinx.io, F-R-I-N-X.io, a company in Slovakia. What they've basically done is they're offering an ODL, Open Daylight Distro, which they'll support.
Mm-hmm.
Based on Cisco's FD.io distribution, Cisco open sourced FD.io, and they've got this ability to build their own, and they're offering that Open Daylight for SoftBank's OpenStack. It's not OpenStack they're supporting, it's Open Daylight, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I was mistaken in how I was positioning it.
So SoftBank is already deep into OpenStack, and then what they're doing is using Frinks for their Open Daylight to manage the network. So
right.
Which is interesting because a lot of people don't believe, like, there's been a lot of FUD coming from the vendors that Open Daylight this and that, and, you know, OpenFlow is dead, and, you know, funny how OpenFlow is solving an awful lot of solutions for people, but nobody talks about it anymore.
Right.
But, you know, you look around hard enough, you'll see there's an awful lot of companies out there making a very fine living out of OpenFlow and Open Daylight, and this is one of them. So I do, you know, you've got to be careful what you listen to, whether it's motivated by it's not a deliberate disinformation campaign, but it is self-serving, and human nature is to support the things that help you. So I do feel that a lot of the criticism that goes towards open source projects tends to come from the vendor sphere, where their personal incomes or their personal position or their emotional status is identified by the position of their vendors. And yeah, it is a good sign that open source is, there's different ways out. I think open source is the biggest challenge open source faces in infrastructure and in networking specifically is that vendors are desperately playing a game of quarter-by-quarter survival, and open source is a year-on-year thing. Like Linux has been around since the late 90s as a substantial thing, and it's really only in the early 2010s that it got legs. Mm-hmm. That's a bit of a, that's a gross generalization, but
yeah,
you know, we've only had Linux really as a mainstream thing for 5 years or so, perhaps, say since 2012. Well, it took 20 years to get there. So why is it that Open Daylight should suddenly burst onto the scene and get penetration in 3 years or 4 years? It's going to take, you know, another 5 to 10, I think.
Yeah, and you know, the point about this is that there's a whole risk avoidance that IT has, which is what leads them down the path of continually hanging on to proprietary products. And the thought that everybody pitches is, you know, well, if this, you know, little startup or this open source project goes flat, you're going to be out of business. And really, from a risk perspective, the proprietary stuff, you have to be all in or all out. There's no way to do it a little bit halfway. And actually, the beauty of open source is because there's a lot of different companies dealing with open source. You've got, even if the vendor, even if this little Frinks company that you're dealing with goes belly up, the underlying technology is still there and it's still going to be supported in the market. You know, Linux is an exit didn't strategy. Go away. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The Open Daylight from Frinks might be different to the generic ODL distribution or the one that Brocade has or the one that Cisco has. I don't know if Cisco still sells its Open Daylight distro. But theoretically, it should be similar enough that you could migrate from one to the other. And that's a feature. Not a bug.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But people don't tend to see it that way. They believe that the proprietary solution they've paid a large amount of money for must last for 20 years because they paid money for it.
Right. And it's not like it's not like Cisco's never killed off a product in the past.
Well, and increasingly Cisco is killing off a lot of products. I mean, they have to. They've got too many. It's hard not to look at any of the vendors. Like, who would have thought that HPE would divest all of those products that it sold off to all those different companies?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how many people bought HPE products only to find that, you know, HP took their whole software division and gave it to Microsoft, Micro Focus.
Right.
And now all of a sudden you thought you were part of a big, safe multinational, and guess what? The world turned. Must be annoying. Although I imagine people are self-justifying that that's perfectly they're looked after because HP is looking after them.
Well, they also look at it and they say, well, this is a smart business decision, and it's going to make HPE more profitable, which means they're going to be around longer in the long run. So I'm trading off a product that I might have liked, but what I'm getting is longer term stability on all the other stuff I already have.
Yeah, on the things you probably aren't going to use from, you know, whether the, you know, proprietary, you know, customized x86 servers is of value, or, you know, hardware-based storage arrays is going to be useful for much longer. I can't see hardware-based storage arrays lasting for long. Not if the x86 continues to move forward and software storage becomes so powerful.
Yeah, and I think you're right on that. And I think storage transforms faster than networking because I've always said compute and storage are endpoints. Networking is the mesh between them all. Mm. And so you can change compute, you can change storage and change one thing. But when you start to change networking, you've got to deal with the fact that it's ingrained and touches everything in your data center. And so storage is going to change and become much more software defined.
Yeah. Oh, yes. No, definitely. But I also think the mistake that people make in their data center networks is to make only one network. They need to make multiple networks in their data center and treat them as pieces. So you should be able to replace one network at a time, and there should be like a half a dozen networks in a good-sized data center so that you can be upgrading one at any given point in time without impacting everything in your data center.
Yeah, yeah. The problem is it's all organic growth. You know, you put in one network and you just keep adding onto it, and nobody's willing to build a second house.
Well, that's where a core pod architecture becomes your thing. And if you had been following me when I speak at conferences, you would know all about that. Well, I think that's just about all we have time for today. Thank you, John, for coming on to the show and to talk to me today. I really appreciate your time.
Well, thanks. It was a good conversation.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Now tell people where they can find you and what you do on the internet.
Sure. You can find me at More Insights and Strategies. That's M-O-O-R, Insights and Strategy. And on Twitter, you can find me at John Free. And that last name is F-R-U-E-H-E.
Okay, and you should follow him along. We have a lovely little snark battle every now and then, which is which is always good fun. Thanks for listening to today's podcast. You can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. Now, maybe you have a blog post in you and you'd like somewhere to go. You are welcome to come publish it at Packet Pushers, and lots of people read that, and that's great. You can follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers. You can find us on the LinkedIn and even on the Facebooks. We don't do a whole lot there. It doesn't seem like much of you are there. And if you're using iTunes or Apple Podcasts, it would be truly grateful if you could give us a rating, because that's the best way to help us grow and to continue bringing you content like this. People find us almost exclusively through iTunes. So do give us a like and a review there. Tell people how awesome we are. And as always, remember that too much technology would never be enough.